Okay, so first I'd just like to say thank you for inviting me. So I'm going to be talking about De Sitter Space. Most of what I'm going to be talking about today is in a paper that came out in December with Raphael Busso and Andy Strominger. I understand Raphael's already talked about parts of this paper, so I'm going to try and emphasize some of the things he didn't get to. And where I do overlap with what he said, I'll try and emphasize a somewhat different point of view. And in the last part of my talk, I'm going to talk about some work in progress with Eva Silverstein and Andy Strominger on constructions of De Sitter space in non-critical string theory. And that's very much a work in progress, so I should warn you in advance. So the outline of my talk today will be as follows. First, I'll just make some kind of brief introductory remarks just to fix the notation. Then I'll go on and talk about the one-parameter family of vacuum states for quantum field theory in De Sitter space. In particular, I'll tell you about a special vacuum state which is associated to the global time coordinate in De Sitter space. And I'll argue that in odd dimensions, it turns out that in a very precise sense, there's no particle creation in this particular vacuum state. Then I'll go on and talk briefly about the DS-CFT interpretation of these results. I'll then proceed to talk about how one might think about defining an inner product on the Hilbert space of quantum field theory in De Sitter space. And in particular, I'll argue that there's a very special and sort of complicated choice of inner product in De Sitter space for which the Virasoro charges of the quantum field theory obey the usual unitarity relation that you get in the conformal field theory, namely Ln dagger is equal to L minus M. So I'll explain that. And then if I have time, I guess I may not, but if I have time, I'll talk about particle detection by Unruh observers in De Sitter space in these vacuum states. And then at the end, I'll talk about this work in progress, which is a construction of De Sitter space in non-critical string theory. And I'll argue that, I'll state a conjecture that these constructions may actually be stable. So I'll talk about that at the end of the talk. So just to remind you of some things we already know, d-dimensional De Sitter space is the hyperboloid sitting inside d plus one-dimensional Minkowski space. So I'll be choosing a time coordinate tau, which is just the vertical axis in this picture, so that tau equals constant slices will be d minus one spheres. Then we can just choose coordinates tau and omega, where omega is a point on that d minus one sphere. And the metric takes this reasonably simple form. The conformal structure of De Sitter space is summed up by a Penrose diagram, which is just a square. So in particular, you can see that tau equals constant slices of this are d minus one spheres again. So there are two boundaries, scry minus and scry plus, which are both spheres. And because the Penrose diagram is a square, associated to any particular observer sitting at a point in De Sitter space. So here, for example, let's consider an observer sitting at the south pole of De Sitter space, which is this line on the right side of the Penrose diagram. Then associated to that observer is a horizon. In particular, this green triangular-shaped region is just the set of all points with which that observer can be in causal contact. That's called the causal diamond, or the causal region, associated to that observer. And so because of that horizon, there's an entropy associated to this causal region, which is just a quarter of the area in Planck units. And any sort of attempt to formulate quantum gravity in De Sitter space would hopefully give one a better understanding of the microscopic origin of that entropy. So are there any questions before I get going? Great. So for most of this talk, I'll be talking about quantum field theory in De Sitter space. So I'll be considering some scalar phi with some mass in a fixed De Sitter background. So I'll be ignoring, for most of this talk, the back reaction of the scalar on the De Sitter geometry. I'm going to take this mass, m, to be bigger than the De Sitter size, which means just m greater than 1 in units where the horizon size is equal to 1. And this is just saying that the Compton wavelength of any particle associated to phi is smaller than the horizon size. Now, it turns out that when you're doing quantum field theory in De Sitter space, unlike the case in flat space, there's no unique choice for the ground state of the theory. And so, oops, it's going up above. So to see why this is, let's just remember how one defines the ground state of a theory. Well, you would choose some appropriate set of modes that are complete and solutions to the wave equation, and then expand the field in terms of these modes. So for example, if these modes phi n are positive frequency and their complex conjugates are negative frequency, then the coefficients in this expansion are just interpreted as creation and annihilation operators. And you can define a ground state to be annihilated by these annihilation operators. Now, in flat space, there's sort of a canonical notion of what you mean by positive frequency modes. In particular, they're ones that go like e to the minus I omega t. But in general, in curve space, there's no canonical choice of what we mean by time. And so that means there won't be any canonical choice of positive frequency modes.
Well, in another way, the vacuum in Kowski space, just to say it's the unique operator in state.
Yeah, that's right. So there's.
There isn't an analogy, of course, to say something
unique to sitter
invariant state. If there is unique.
There's a one-parameter family of de Sitter invariant states, and so that's the point, is that there is no unique de Sitter invariant state. So, in particular, it turns out, as I just said, there's a one complex parameter family of de Sitter invariant states, and just to motivate for you why that might be true. Let's just remember that in a free theory, everything we might want to know about that theory is determined by the two-point function. And so that's just the expectation value of phi x, phi y, and the vacuum state. Now, if the vacuum's de Sitter invariant, then this is just some function g of theta, where theta is the geodesic distance. So this Green's function is going to satisfy the wave equation, which is just some second-order differential equation. So there's going to be two linearly independent solutions to this wave equation. So here I've just written down the answer in three dimensions. And one might imagine that these parameters A and B could be complex, so there might be a two complex parameter family of de Sitter invariant vacua. But just by, for example, fixing the short distance singularity to have the usual flat space form, then that reduces you down to a one complex parameter family of vacua. And so, yeah, I don't want to emphasize it too much, but this first term, when theta, the geodesic distance, is small, goes like 1 over theta, so that's just the usual short distance singularity that we know and love from flat space, whereas the second term is singular outside the light cone. So naively, one might think that such vacuum states would be unphysical, but it turns out that it's singular only when the two points x and y are separated by a horizon. So we're going to take the point of view that these vacuum states are physical because of that. OK? Is that clear?
A and B aren't real.
I mean,
phi's a real field.
I think you can take them to be complex. It just means.
A and B are Hermitian
fields. Sorry?
But if A and B are real, if phi is a real field.
G is not going to be real in general. The real part of it is going to be the anti-commutator, and the imaginary part would be the commutator.
But A and B are constants, right?
That's right. So, for example. No, I mean, so this is the
white. Is field, the commutator.
But this is the Whiteman function. It's not the commutator or the anti-commutator.
But phi is a real field.
No, I mean, if you take the complex conjugate of that, you just switch x and y.
Switch x and y, that the complex conjugate of a relation.
Yeah.
That must put some constraints on A and B. I don't see why you said you had two complex parameters and then you used one complex parameter. I'm just confused about reality conditions for Hermitian fields.
No, if you complex conjugate this, you switch x and y, which, well, depending on your I epsilon prescription, may or may not change the signs of some of these.
Beta is invariant.
Well, it depends. Actually, it's a little subtle. It depends on your I epsilon prescription. So, I don't want to.
That must say something about A and B. Whether they're complex numbers, that means you have just complex numbers.
Well, no. I mean, you could, for example, it depends on which branches of these functions you choose.
Yeah. this kind of reality condition. After all, if I had a permission field, it would be more, the Green's function would have more variables. If a permission field has to be a reality condition, G of X and Y.
Okay, I mean, in principle, there are four different, in principle, there are four different terms you could take. You could take this term or this term with a certain I epsilon prescription, or you could take the ones with the opposite I epsilon prescription. And
so
we're only taking
X, Y different points, there's not I epsilon. And there's a condition coming from reality, no?
Yeah, sure there is. Sure there is. And that's why we only have two here instead of four.
Two what?
Two solutions here. I mean, in principle, there are four different terms I could imagine putting into this Green's function.
I thought that the restriction term, the restriction to the standard for distance behavior comes in later to select among the desiderium variant vacuum, one that is Euclidean.
Yeah, that's if you want the normal I epsilon prescription. I wasn't planning on talking about that.
I see two real ones.
Okay.
And one of them is just a normalization, right? One real parameter.
Yeah. I mean, if you want CPT invariant vacua, there'll be one real parameter. There's one, if you include CPT, under the...
The two parameters essentially control the strength. One real parameter controls the strength of the antipodal, the singularity at the antipodal point, and the other one controls the degree to which CPT invariance is broken.
Right. Maybe we can just, this is sort of a small point.
So for example,
in
even dimensions, the second parameter would distinguish between the in vacuum and the out vacuum.
I'm going to get to this, so maybe we can just continue. So what I'd like to do is now tell you about two very special choices for these vacuum states. So let's just consider some field configuration phi which satisfies the equations of motion. Then they're going to be, this is a second order differential equation, so they're going to be two linearly independent solutions. Now, near scrum minus, which is to say when tau goes to minus infinity, these solutions are just e to the h plus tau and e to the h minus tau, where h plus and minus are just these two complex numbers. So you can see that near scrum minus, a simple choice of modes would be just modes that go like e to the h minus tau, because those are just positive frequency modes with respect to the time coordinate tau near scrum minus. So I'm just going to choose modes that behave like this. And in general, in the bulk, they'll have some complicated form. But near scrum minus, we can just decompose phi in terms of these modes. And the decomposition just takes this form in terms of two functions on the sphere, which I've called phi plus of omega and phi minus of omega. So these two functions determine a complete set of boundary data for phi on scrum minus. And in the quantum field theory language, they're just position space raising operators and lowering operators on the Fock space. So in particular, this operator phi plus at omega creates a state with an incoming particle at the point omega on scrum minus. And you can define a vacuum state associated to this choice of raising and lowering operators. And that's just the state, which I'll call in, with no incoming particles on scrum minus. Now, de Sitter transformations, at least in three dimensions, is just the conformal group in two dimensions. So it's easy to describe the action of the de Sitter group in this, the language of conformal transformations. Now, in particular, near scrum minus, the de Sitter Killing symmetries just reduce to the conformal transformations on scrum minus. And so this set of raising operators, phi plus, transform with weight h plus under the conformal group, and the lowering operators transform with weight h minus. So in particular, under de Sitter transformations, they don't mix, which means that this in vacuum is de Sitter invariant. Is that clear? Great. So hopefully what I've demonstrated is that this in vacuum is indeed one of the family of de Sitter invariant vacuum states. And you can do a similar decomposition near scribe plus, decomposing phi in terms of two functions, phi out of omega and phi out plus of omega and phi out minus of omega, and define a similar state, which is the state with no outgoing particles on scribe plus. And now the only thing to notice here is that whereas near scribe minus, the creation operator is transformed with weight h plus, and the annihilation operator is transformed with weight h minus, near scribe plus, there's the opposite prescription, namely that the annihilation operator is here transformed with weight h plus, and the creation operator is transformed with weight h minus. Okay? So a natural question to ask would be how these different vacuum states are related. So first, let me tell you the answer in four dimensions. In four dimensions, it turns out that these four different types of boundary data are related in some very complicated way. So if I try and write the in-state in terms of the out Fock space operators, it's some complicated excited state. And in fact, it's a thermal state with some temperature, which is just the de Sitter temperature. And so this was actually one of the original ways of seeing that there's a temperature in de Sitter space in four dimensions. And so the sort of surprising result is that in three dimensions, there's no mixing. In particular, creation operators on scribe minus evolve just to creation operators on scribe plus. And so the in vacuum is equal to the out vacuum. So in this very, what's that? Any 5, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11. There are more of them. And so this fact, you know, is sort of really surprising at first sight, but there's actually a very simple way of deriving it, and let me describe that to you. So remember that these two functions, phi in plus and minus, are a complete set of boundary data for the field phi. So in particular, they completely determine phi out plus or minus. And the formula for this is some complicated non-local evolution. In particular, phi out at a particular point on the sphere is determined by integrating phi in with some kernel. And so the first thing I should point out is, well, phi out plus, which is a creation operator, actually no, phi out plus, which is an annihilation operator, is just determined by the sum of annihilation operators, which is just the statement that the in vacuum is equal to the out vacuum. And moreover, the kernel that you integrate with is just the two-point function for operators of weight h plus on the sphere. And in fact, you can derive this relation just by looking at the asymptotic behavior of the Green's function in where one point's on scribe minus and the other point's on scribe plus. And so all you have to do is just take that Green's function that I wrote down for you a couple of transparencies ago and just take some limits. So now the question.
In is equal to out is not surprising. That's what happens in flat
space.
The fact that in is not equal to out is surprising.
The fact that in is equal to out 20 years after we all thought in was not equal to out is what's surprising. So
it is surprising because your curve background and in and out are defined with respect to the.
Yeah. I mean.
In the background of that symmetry, it's surprising.
No. Well, I mean.
Besides which, so what's the explanation of the difference between out and out? Curvature creates particles that looks at the number of dimensions.
Somehow. I think it's not completely clear how to interpret that. It was sort of amazing when we discovered it originally,
but
because
as you say, the vacuum is unique. It's not so obvious.
Yeah, I mean,
it, what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, it depends which vacuum state you're in.
When you have asymptotic in flat spaces, and you have some curvature in between. Mm-hmm. It's clear that you get particle creation.
Right.
There's a unique way of finding
I think the generic statement is that if you pick any two vacuum that are not defined exactly the identical way, then the generic thing to happen is that there's particle creation.
Yeah.
Well, I can always surprise them here is that
I can always pick and it's just the argument you went through. A vacuum, an out vacuum, so if you can part of it.
Well, I mean, in what sense is that an out vacuum then?
The same as in vacuum.
Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of trivial statement. You can just.
The article listed there are two vacuum which are clearly of some physical relevance
yeah.
in this space.
I mean, you're saying
well,
I can just.
I would like you to explain them, you know, it's a difference between odd and different dimensions. One where it's naturally a word where
well, okay.
If you relate to Huygens principle, I mean, in flat space, we know there's a difference between odd and even dimensions, and mm-hmm. massless fields in one case propagate all the light cone,
yeah.
massless fields in other case go inside.
Yeah.
Now, here you have curvature, so I'm
yeah.
not quite sure.
Well,
but
I mean,
formally flat.
If you look at the Green's functions in odd versus even dimensions, in even dimensions, they have some very simple form. Sorry, in odd dimensions, they have some very simple form. In fact, in the complex plane, they just have. They're mirror morphic, so they just have, you know, some discrete number of singular points. But in even dimensions, they actually have branch cuts and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. So I think that might be the generalization of the curve space generalization of this principle. But I'm not completely sure. Okay. So now, how could we realize the whole family of vacuum states in this language? Well, in order to define a new vacuum state, we would need to define some new raising operators out of the old raising and lowering operators. So in particular, instead of an in state, which is annihilated by the in guys, we'd like to define some new state, which is annihilated by some combination of the in creation and annihilation operators. Now, this linear combination I've written for you right there isn't de Sitter invariant, because I'm taking a combination of something that transforms with weight h minus and something that transforms with weight h plus. So what we really need is we need some combination of raising operators that transform with weight h minus instead of h plus. And I've already told you exactly what they are. They're just the raising operators on scry plus instead of on scry minus. So the appropriate de Sitter invariant combination would just be some linear combination of the lowering operators on scry minus with the raising operators on scry plus. And so here I've written the complex parameter relating those two as gamma. And in fact, gamma would have to be real if you want this new state to be CPT invariant. Now, with respect to scry minus, this is some, you know, horrible non-local condition. Where again, you would have to integrate with the two-point function on the sphere, but I think, yeah. But just by sort of symmetry considerations, we've managed to, you know, completely pin that down. Okay. So, for example, one of the states in this family of vacua is the Euclidean vacuum. That's the one whose modes are defined by analytic continuation from the sphere. This is the special vacuum state with no singularities outside of the light cone. And actually, as was shown by Spradlin and Volovich, there's a sense in which there's no flux coming across the horizon, in the same sense that these in and out vacua have no flux going from scry minus or from scry plus.
So that vacuum is no particle creation?
There is particle creation. There's the usual thermal particle creation in all dimensions. That's right. Any other questions?
You talk about the Euclidean vacuum.
That's right.
That's one state. So, I mean, if you take the same state in the past and the future and everywhere, then there's no particle creation. But I think
right.
what you mean is that.
What I mean is that an Unruh detector,
yeah.
you know, if you don't.
The following one,
right.
will register thermal.
Sure. Yeah.
Vacuum
particles. Yeah. And in fact, it's the case that in these in and out states, an Unruh detector will also see some particle creation, but it's not thermal. So maybe I'll discuss that at the end if I have time, but I probably won't.
Even in odd dimensions?
Even in odd dimensions. And so I think the interpretation is that this detector never comes into thermal equilibrium or something like that. We haven't, it's sort of a surprising result.
Maybe two different questions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a physical sense in which, I mean, it depends which question you're asking. So. So, quantum gravity in de Sitter space has been conjectured to be dual to a boundary CFT. And these four types of boundary data that I've told you about correspond to four operators, phi O in plus and minus, and O out plus and minus. And although, you know, in principle, because there are two boundaries, one might think that there would be two conformal field theories. And the fact that there's only a single de Sitter isometry group, which is a single copy of the conformal group, means that there's really just a single conformal field theory. So in particular, because the de Sitter isometry is reduced to conformal transformations on scribe plus and scribe minus, these two copies of the sphere, scribe plus and scribe minus, are acted on by only one copy of the conformal group. So in particular, if I took, you know, some de Sitter isometry and I took the limit near scribe minus, that would give me one, you know, that would give me one conformal transformation. But that same isometry would give me a different conformal transformation on scribe plus. So you have these set of correlators on two spheres, but they're invariant only under a single copy of the conformal group. So that's the sense in which this is a single conformal field theory.
Well, until you spell out what you mean by the correspondence.
Yeah, well, okay. No, I mean, you have some set of correlators, and they're invariant under a single copy of the conformal group, and so that's...
Oh, yeah, you have two sets of correlators, each invariant under the same conformal group.
That's right.
But you... What do you mean by the connection anyway? What are the rules of homology?
I mean, okay, well...
The moment.
Maybe
the initial statement.
Well, if you believe that one state in the bulk corresponds to one in the boundary, then I think Alex's argument shows that
corresponds to one state in the bulk.
Yeah, so you can act with a symmetry group on that. That should be a minimal requirement.
Yeah, well, okay, so actually, yeah. Okay, anyway. So in Strominger's original calculation, he actually, by studying the asymptotic symmetries, made a prediction for the central charge of this, putative boundary theory. And in principle, the easiest way to get this would be just by studying the graviton two-point function in de Sitter space. And this is actually sort of a technically more difficult problem than it might sound. And that's actually something that we're working on now. So, the specific proposal.
I guess I still understand. I mean, I have correlation functions in the ball, which could go between two points in the boundary, or between two different boundaries.
That's right.
In what sense are those determined by one boundary theory?
You have some set of correlators on two spheres, but. You know, the symmetries of de Sitter space guarantee that these correlators are invariant only under a single copy of the conformal group.
In one case, they're correlated between one sphere and another sphere.
Well, no, you just have two spheres.
But the operate, so
I mean, you could think of them as correlators on one sphere. Like, there's no reason why you couldn't just, you would just have to take the appropriate map between one sphere and the other, and that's precisely the non-local mapping that I gave for you on the a few transparencies ago.
You can't do a conformal transformation here without doing one here.
Exactly, yeah. And that's because they have to be, that's because, you know, from the de Sitter space point of view, they're related by some Kirling symmetry in the bulk. So the simplest example is if I wanted to just do a rotation here, then they're related by some hyperboloid, so I have to do a rotation here. Now, the specific proposal is that two-point functions of these operators are appropriate coefficients of Green's functions on scribe minus or scribe plus. So for example, near scribe minus, the Green's function just reduces to the two-point function on a sphere for operators of weight h plus. And so we identify this as the correlator between o plus and o plus on scribe minus. So here, the fact that the Green's function depends on the choice of vacuum means that there's actually a one-parameter family of conformal field theory correlators defined by this prescription. And the relation between these different sets of correlators is rather simple. All that happens is that the coefficient of this correlator changes as a function of which vacuum state you're in. Now,
the relation function of these operators, purported CFT, are Green's functions are in that.
That's right. So I think a better way. So you just take a Green's function, a Green's function.
Green's function, 2 points in that sphere, that's one Green's function.
That's okay. I have a Green's function. If I take one of the points to scribe plus and one of the points to scribe minus, that defines a correlator between an O plus and an O minus. If I take both of the points on scribe minus, that defines for me a correlator between two operators on scribe minus.
So I have two sets of this component field theory has to have sort of an operator for one sphere operator.
But they're related to each other.
Yeah, they're related to each other, and this. Well, they're related to each other by this. Well, we know that the boundary data for the field phi are related to each other because, you know, only it takes only two functions to specify a complete set of boundary data. So the idea is that these four operators, because they correspond to, you know, an overdetermined system of boundary data.
I understand, but in the conformal field theory, what does it mean? Do I only have one set of operators?
I think it's not 100% clear, but I think the idea is that yeah, you only have only one set of operators rather than.
What determines this relation?
Well, it's precisely the relation between the boundary data.
Operator one equals integral kernel operator two.
Sure.
But that's pretty weird.
I mean, yeah. Well, I mean,
it's a very constrained.
Different bases.
Yeah, I mean, you can choose some set of operators, O in plus and O in minus.
With a complete set of operators, which you call O plus.
Mm-hmm. Or O in, say, O scribe plus or something like that.
And then you say, and that's it.
That's right. Because you can determine the scribe minus ones in terms of those. So.
In the free field theory, I see you have this determination. Mm-hmm. But what is the abstract connection? I mean, how would you do this generally? Generally, you're not interested in free field. I mean, this is clearly an issue because we've heard many sides of the story.
Indeed.
Over the months.
Yeah. No, I mean.
I'm just asking whether it really is coherent now, or it's still in flux because I don't get it.
Okay. Well.
I mean, each time it's presented as if it's coherent, but is it? Would you guys agree?
I don't think we've gotten beyond the free field.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Or, well, I mean, in terms of.
But in the free field theory, you know the answers.
Well, in an interacting field theory, I mean, Spradlin and Volovich, you know, wrote down a prescription for some general interacting field theory in terms of S matrix elements on scribe minus and scribe plus.
That means you have to solve the Bolt theory in order to define what you mean by the Bolt theory. Know what the connection between the O plus and the O minus operator.
Yeah, I mean, in principle, yeah.
That's sort of not the way we usually describe holography.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so, okay. Anyway, so I've argued that in the bulk description, the different vacua are related in this complicated non-local way. And so one might ask whether these different sets of conformal field theory correlators are related. And it turns out they're just related by some marginal deformation. By this operator of weight 2.
You mean to change this one term also?
Exactly. Yeah. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about the choice of inner product in this quantum field theory. So the usual. So the. What's that? I think, in free field theory, it's marginal. Yeah, I think we just don't know in general. So the usual definition of an adjoint for a real scalar field would just be that if we expand phi in terms of some positive frequency and negative frequency modes that are complex conjugates, then we would just say that these two coefficients in this decomposition are adjoints. But the problem is that if we write down the Virasoro charges in the bulk theory, so this would just be some integral over some Cauchy surface of the normal vector contracted with the appropriate conserved current. And so that conserved current's just some stress tensor contracted with an appropriately chosen Killing vector. Then with this definition of adjoint, Ln dagger is just Ln bar, which differs from the usual relation that we would expect in a conformal field theory. And so this problem can actually be remedied with a new choice of what we mean by adjoint. So the usual definition of adjoint would just be, we take some phi plus operator at a point omega, and we replace that by the phi minus operator. So we just replace creation and annihilation operators. So instead, what I want to do is start with the state on scry plus, evolve it up to, start with the state on scry minus, evolve it up to scry plus, and then act with CBT to get a state back down on scry minus. So now, this time evolution is this non-local operation involving convolving with the two-point function on the sphere. Charge acts trivially. We're going to take charge to act trivially just because it's a real scalar. Parity is some operation on the sphere. And time reversal is some antilinear operation which takes operators on phi out on scry plus to operators on scry minus. And so what you end up with is some sort of complicated non-local notion of adjoint on scry minus. And it just turns out that with this notion of adjoint, the Virasoro charges obey the sort of the appropriate conformal field theory unitarity relation. And I think there's a sense in which this notion of adjoint can be thought of as inherited from the conformal field theory, because, so in particular, let me point out to you that the kernel involved in this sort of weird choice of adjoint is a two-point function between a point omega and another point, which involves an antipodal map on the sphere and a parity transformation. And so that antipodal map and parity transformation is just the usual thing that you get for a free boson on the Euclidean plane. So in particular, if I take some free field X, I expand it in terms of raising and lowering operators, then the adjoint is not the field X at the same point, but the field X at some different point, which leads you to have this sort of funny relation between omega and this other point on the sphere with this parity and this antipodal map. Okay. So now I'll just talk for a few minutes about particle detection. So let's consider some detector. So this is an UNRU detector moving along some world line parameterized by x of tau, and it has some monopole coupling to the scalar field. So the interaction term for this detector will just be some operator m, which acts on the detector Hilbert space, times some operator phi, which acts on the Fock space of the theory. The total Hilbert space of the theory is just the tensor product of these two Hilbert spaces. And I'm going to take this detector Hilbert space just to be spanned by some energy eigenstates. So then the transition amplitude to go between some detector state EI and the Fock vacuum to some other state EJ and some excited state in the field theory is just the matrix element of this interaction term. So it's just some integral over the particle world line of this matrix element. So if I want to calculate the transition probability per unit time, well, we don't measure the final state of this decay, so we should sum over it, and we need to square this amplitude. And what we end up with is some integral over the particle world line of some phase. So here, if I want to know the probability to decay from a state EI to a state EJ, then the phase is just e to the minus delta E, where delta E is the difference in energies between the two states, times some Green's function, between two points on the detector world line. So what sort of answer might we expect to get from this calculation? Well, if the states of the detector are thermally populated, then the detailed balance principle would just say that the rate of transition from state EI to EJ is precisely equal to the rate of transition from EJ to EI. And so that these probabilities from EI to EJ to EJ to EI would just be related by the usual Boltzmann factor. So now, first, let me tell you what the answer is for the Euclidean vacuum. Well, remember, we have to do this integral of the Green's function. And so I wrote down for you earlier what the Green's function is in the Euclidean vacuum. And so I don't want you to pay too much attention to the formula, but just to note that this Green's function has poles everywhere along the imaginary axis in tau, where tau is just the proper time along the detector world line, except it has no pole when tau is equal to minus pi I. And so the interpretation of that is actually pretty simple. So you remember that I told you the Euclidean vacuum is precisely the one which has no singularities outside the light cone. So if the point, if one of my points is here at this blue X, then the usual short distance singularity in quantum field theory is just where tau is equal to zero, so it's on this blue dotted line. And the fact that and tau is equal to minus pi I is just this point over here behind the horizon. And so the fact that the Euclidean vacuum has no singularity there is just the fact that all of the singularities in the Euclidean vacuum are on the light cone. So then the detector response is just some contour integral. And so remember, I told you that there are so if each of these x's is a singularity of the Green's function, then there's no singularity right here. So the detector response, which is some integral along the real tau axis, is then related just by completing the contour below by this other integral down here. If I just write down this relation, I get some relation between these integrals, which is precisely the condition for detailed balance that I told you about on the previous transparency. So this is just a really slick derivation of the fact that in the Euclidean vacuum, an inner detector has temperature equal to 1 over 2 pi. And just looking at this, you can automatically see that in these other vacua, there's going to be some different situation. And the reason is that there's an antipodal singularity. So there's another singularity outside the light cone, where tau is equal to minus pi I, which corresponds to just inserting another pole here. So when I try and do this contour integral, I pick up a contribution from the pole. And this leads to a non-thermal detector response. So in particular, the ratio between these two different transition probabilities is the usual Boltzmann factor times some other complicated mess. So the derivation's a little messy, but is the result clear? Are there any questions on that? Okay. So just to summarize, that even though there's this very precise sense in which there's no particle creation in these global vacua, a monopole detector is going to see some sort of weird non-thermal behavior. Okay? So now let me just talk briefly about the entropy. I guess Raphael might have talked a little bit about this, so I can just remind you of it. So let's just consider a scalar field sitting in De Sitter space. So the usual way that one would get some thermal density matrix out of this would be to start with a pure state, the Euclidean vacuum, divide the Euclidean modes into modes on one side of the horizon and on the other side of the horizon. So here I've written an S for the region associated with an observer sitting on the south pole of the sphere, and an N for the region associated with observers on the north pole of the sphere. If we just trace over the modes behind the horizon, then that turns this pure state into a density matrix. And it turns out that this is a thermal density matrix at the de Sitter temperature. So it has the form e to the minus beta, where beta is 1 over the temperature, times L0 plus L0 bar, where these are just the various Auer charges that I wrote down for you in a previous transparency. Is that familiar to people? Now, you can actually do the same thing in Kerr de Sitter, which is just the geometry of a black hole with mass m and angular momentum j sitting in de Sitter space. And the only change is that this beta, which was 1 over the de Sitter temperature, is actually becomes complex. So roughly speaking, the real part of beta corresponds to the temperature of Kerr de Sitter, and the imaginary part of beta corresponds to some angular potential. And now, Kerr de Sitter also has an entropy, which is just a quarter of the area of the horizon. So here, I'm just talking about three dimensions again. So there's no black hole horizon in three dimensions because it's just a conical deficit. And so the area of the horizon is just some function of the mass and the angular momentum, which I've written over here. And it turns out that you can actually motivate this answer from a conformal field theory point of view. And so I should warn you ahead of time that this derivation involves a lot of assumptions, not all of which are justified, but I think the answer is sort of interesting anyway. So I want to just consider a conformal field theory partition function at fixed beta, so at fixed temperature and angular potential. And then the partition function is just the integral L0, L0 bar of some density of states times the usual Boltzmann factor. And if we just assume that Cardy's formula holds, which is, you know, a very big assumption, if we just assume Cardy's formula with this particular choice of the central charge, and then plug in the usual formula for the entropy in the canonical ensemble, then this precisely reproduces the Kerr de Sitter entropy. And so I should emphasize that there's no, you know, real solid reason why we should expect Cardy's formula to hold in this boundary conformal field theory, because in particular, it has operators of complex weight, so we don't know that it's unitary. So I think that this could be taken as more of some indication of what sort of conformal field theory we would expect based on our knowledge about gravity and de Sitter space. And also, I should probably also emphasize that from the CFT point of view, we haven't really answered the question, where does this temperature come from? Where does this value of beta come from? So we haven't yet given the prescription that would define for you this density matrix in the conformal field theory. And so similar considerations have also appeared by these guys down here. So let me just sort of summarize what I've said for you so far. I've talked about a one-parameter family of vacuum states in de Sitter space. I've argued that there are special vacuum states in and out that are actually in corresponds to no particles incident from scry minus, out corresponds to no particles outgoing on scry plus, and the fact that they're equal is just tells you that there's no particle production in this state in de Sitter space in odd dimensions. Now, it turns out that this one-parameter family of vacua has a sort of elegant interpretation in the conformal field theory language. In particular, it's a line of marginal deformations. I've defined for you a new non-local, at least from the scry minus point of view, inner product on the Hilbert space of this quantum field theory, for which the Virasoro charges obey the usual unitarity relation. And I've motivated for you, at least, what the possible CFT origin of the de Sitter entropy could be. So are there any questions on this before I move on to other things? So in the last few minutes, I want to talk about some work in progress with Eva Silverstein and Andy Strominger. So I should warn you ahead of time that this is very much in progress. So the starting point is a construction by Silverstein about a year ago. So she considered a non-critical string theory in some d greater than 10 dimensions, compactified it on d minus 4 compact directions, toroidal directions at the self-dual radius. Then she modded out by the action of some complicated asymmetric orientifold group, which projects out all the moduli of these compact directions. And she ended up with some dilaton potential in the remaining four directions, which I've written here in Einstein frame. So there are three contributions to this potential, the first of which is just the usual term coming from non-criticality. So that's proportional to d minus 10. And that's just the usual tree-level cosmological constant you get in a non-critical string theory. There's a second term which comes from the orientifolds. So that just goes like the sum of the tensions of the orientifolds, actually times the volumes of the cycles on which they're wrapped. And there's a third term which comes from some fluxes that she put into the theory. And so, you know, there are many different types of these constructions one could consider. In particular, you could choose different flux quanta to put on these extra dimensions. And when you have a large number of supercritical dimensions, there are in general many, many different choices of flux quanta that one could put on it. And so this is a very large family of models. So the dilaton potential looks something like this. And what Silverstein demonstrated is that there actually exist models. So there exist choices of these parameters which give you de Sitter solutions. So that's to say some local minimum of this dilaton potential. And the solutions that she found had a cosmological constant that was about an order of magnitude below string scale. So that's to say that the de Sitter radius is a couple of order of magnitudes above string scale. So this is nice, but it's not great from the point of view of low energy gravity. And so it turns out that with some mild generalizations of her model, one can actually generalize this construction to get arbitrarily small cosmological constant. So in particular, this requires taking some large number of dimensions, but it's actually not a very large number of dimensions. So if one wants to get, so it turns out that the cosmological constant decreases exponentially with the number of dimensions. So in order to get some realistic cosmological constant, you wouldn't need, you know, some fantastically large number of dimensions, but some number you could count to, probably. I should also probably mention that the string coupling, which is just E, the exponential of the value of the dilaton at this local minimum, can also be made arbitrarily small. So this is a class of models with arbitrarily small cosmological constant and weak string coupling. So are there any questions on that? No questions?
Yeah. I guess I have a question. Is this supposed to be phenomenologically interesting?
Well, okay, I think right now it's at the statement of a proof of principle that one actually can get these sorts of backgrounds. I wouldn't say that it's phenomenologically interesting.
I might be mistaken, but I thought that non-critical strings are they have goals and things like that.
Well, I mean, I think the status isn't entirely clear. So we're taking the point of view that one can write down the beta function equations, so the low energy equation, and solve them. And so this is, I mean, de Sitter space with this dilaton potential really is a solution of the beta function equations. So
how many, what is the dimension?
Well, okay, so Okay, to get a cosmological constant, lambda goes like 2 to the minus number of dimensions, something like that. So it would be some large but not humongously large number. 120, for example.
But that really is highly
critical. That's highly, yeah. So I think that's actually one of the issues that we're really dealing with right now. So one might worry, for example, that higher loop terms would pick up large numbers of extra factors from degrees of freedom running around in these loops. And so although we can construct these models with very small string coupling, this might be compensated for by the fact that there are large numbers of, in fact, exponentially large numbers of degrees of freedom running around these loops. So that's why, you know, I want to warn that this is very much a work in progress. So that's something that we're, so, I mean, there are various ways of playing around with these models to try and make up for that, but that's, I mean, that's very much an issue. So we just, if one just assumes that you can do this, that you can do this without worrying too much about how small you need to get the string coupling, then it's fine. I mean, but granted, that's a big assumption. It's something we're thinking about. Okay. So now a question, an important question would be the stability of the theory. So now the fact that this De Sitter minimum is just a local minimum rather than a global minimum means that in general one would expect these theories to be unstable to tunnel to flat space, which is the minimum when phi goes to minus infinity. So this instability has been described by a gravitational instanton. And it turns out that Euclidean solutions interpolating between these two minima exist for all dilaton potentials u of phi. And so this might lead one to conclude that this De Sitter solution is always unstable. And I'd like to argue that there's some evidence, at least, that this is not true. So what do these instanton solutions look like? Well, they interpolate between the Euclidean sphere and flat space. So what these solutions look like is just a sphere with some section removed and replaced by a flat disk. And the Lorentzian solutions, so to find the Lorentzian solution, well, remember that the usual De Sitter hyperboloid just kind of looks like this, and the prescription for gravitational instantons says that we should take the tau equals zero slice of De Sitter space and replace it by the Euclidean time equals zero slice of the instanton that I showed you on the previous transparency. So in particular, the tau equals zero slice is a d minus one sphere, and the Euclidean time equals zero slice of that instanton, it's a d minus one sphere with some section replaced by a disk. And so that looks like a bubble of flat space that's spontaneously nucleated inside De Sitter space. And in terms of the hyperboloid, it looks something like this, where at tau less than zero, it just looks like normal De Sitter space. And then at tau equals zero, there's some quantum event, and some region of the De Sitter space just disappears, and a bubble of flat space is created. And here, these two points here represent the wall of this bubble of flat space, and the region of flat space is this green area in between. And so this bubble then expands outwards at a speed asymptotically approaching the speed of light. So a question would be, how big is this bubble of flat space? And so first, remember that it's going to cost some energy to create this bubble. And the energy is going to go like the tension times the radius squared, where the tension is just determined by the profile of the dilaton potential. And so it costs some energy to create the bubble, but you also gain some energy by making this transition, which just goes like the cosmological constant times the volume of the region of de Sitter space that you destroy. And so energy conservation tells you that this bubble should be nucleated at zero energy. And so the radius just increases as the tension of the domain wall increases. And so I've really pulled a fast one here. I mean, one would actually have to include the gravitational corrections to this energy and the factors coming from the curvature volume to this energy here. But the basic idea, I think, is clear from this picture. Are there any questions? So if the radius of this bubble increases with the tension, what happens when the tension is very, very large and the radius is comparable to the de Sitter radius? So this corresponds to the tension being larger than some critical value, which goes like the square root of lambda. So when the tension is equal to the critical value, the Euclidean solution just looks like a hemisphere. And when the tension's much, much larger than this critical value, you can still find the Euclidean solutions, but they just look like some very, very small slice of the end of this sphere. And the Lorentzian solutions just look like this diagram here. So in particular, if you remember that the causal region associated to an observer at the South Pole is just this purple triangle here, then the causal region's been completely destroyed by this nucleation process. So if you believe that the appropriate that quantum gravity in de Sitter space is described by some unitary evolution on the causal diamond, then this is a process which completely destroys the causal diamond and violates unitarity. So our conjecture is that for these reasons, this process should be forbidden. And so let me just restate this proposition for you in a couple of different ways.
How can you formulate the rules of
well,
quantum mechanics on the causal diamond?
Well, I mean, we don't know what the rules are. I mean, so let me continue for a few minutes, and then we can discuss this. So an instanton is some solution to the Euclidean equations of motion with some boundary conditions. That's sort of the traditional notion of what an instanton is. Now, de Sitter space has no boundary, so it's not entirely clear what conditions, if any, one should impose on these instanton solutions. So if you believe that the right observables are those associated to a causal region, then one could imagine that the right prescription would be to impose boundary conditions at the horizon. And these superhorizon bubbles violate these boundary conditions.
See, something's assuming you're arguing against an instanton, which is an answer to a well-defined set of one calculation. Mm-hmm. Tunnel means is something that you can argue for that exists, whether or not it's given by an instanton. Instanton just happens to be the dominant mechanism that gives you the biggest amplitude. But whether you can tunnel through a barrier, just, you know, there's a barrier, you can tunnel through. So there's always some probability that you don't create this big bubble for a large tension.
Okay,
but
let me.
Small bubble. It's true.
What is the value of V double prime over V at that maximum?
I'm not absolutely sure.
Yeah, that question was asked and answered at the by Andre at your 60th birthday party. And the answer is that the curvature is always such that the Hawking mass instanton is not going to dominate in the models that they stand. Stephen is asking whether it isn't more likely that you actually jump to the top of the of the hill rather than tunneling through the barrier.
Okay.
Whatever, but in order to rule out instability, it's not just enough to argue that
I think
instanton is ruled out.
You know, some comment on that
boundary condition of causality, but to argue that any tunneling would be instanton. I mean, you know, there's the solution of the Euclidean equations of motion that corresponds to tunneling through a grain where a small bubble, which isn't, you know, if you believe the instant calculation, the dominant thing that would happen.
Right.
But as long as it occurs with any non vanishing probability, the thing is unstable.
Okay, let me...
So you have to argue that there's sort of any barrier penetration has zero amplitude. No.
Okay, well...
Are you possible?
Okay, let me... Okay, let me give you sort of maybe a different argument, which might make you happier, which is that even if these... So the condition that I wrote down, the bound on the tension, is actually just precisely the condition that the decay time is longer than the Poincaré recurrence time. So I think... I mean, I would argue that even if, you know, this nucleation of very small bubbles is possible, and it takes, but if the decay rate is so small that, you know, the expected lifetime for this process is much longer than the Poincaré recurrence time, that... Well, I mean, that's...
You're now having this interpretation of this interspace. So what happens? What do you mean?
Well, so the point is that anything...
The difference between the decay and...
Well, no, I mean, the point is that there's some...
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Can I go just quickly? I mean, I think you can ask the question, how well can you do in principle in super space? Doesn't even mean anything to ask whether the super space can last forever. And I think if you believe that there's a finite number of states in the super space, that question doesn't mean anything.
So that's part of the answer? In string theory, there clearly isn't a finite number of states.
Well...
The examples that people have.
Wait a minute, how does this make sense? If you have a theory with a finite number of states to start with, then how are you going to nucleate flat space anyway, which is expensive, because then it would seem if you have a limited number of states in the flat space.
I think what's happening is that we're extending the Euclidean approach to a regime where we really don't know whether we can trust it. And I think what's happening is that as we exit the regime where we can trust it, we also exit the regime where the question has any meaning. So I just wouldn't care about it. The point is that you can make it stable long enough that you can ask any question that you might possibly want to ask it.
Sorry? Long enough from when? I think long enough in terms of...
Am I starting to count this time?
Well, just in terms of the...
Say for, yeah.
From now.
When some structure forms.
Yeah.
The radiation. Let's start.
Okay, well, I should emphasize that this is really just a conjecture at this point, and that...
What's a conjecture?
Well, that this construction would be stable, or at least, you know, stable up to this Poincaré recurrence time. And until we really know the rules for quantum gravity and De Sitter space, we're not going to be...
The Poincaré recurrence time really is connected with the idea that there's a finite number of degrees of freedom. And it doesn't make any sense to ask anything with time
greater. Yeah.
But that's a pretty radical point of view. And I don't see how it's substantiated by...
Well...
Is what?
Like the entropy.
I mean, I'm not claiming that this is a proof here. This is a conjecture, and it's something, you know, to try and test or not to test. And now it turns out that, at least for this process, it fundamentally involves back reaction. And so if one tried to just, you know, use, for example, some techniques of field theory in curved space to study the superhorizon decay, you know, you would find out that you can't do it, because in the approximation where you ignore back reaction, then all of the bubbles are subhorizon. And so, in fact, you know, we've had a very difficult time trying to study this process more precisely because of that. So in particular, you could imagine just studying, you know, something in a fixed De Sitter background, and then you can always take a bubble and put it very close to the horizon, and then its energy will be redshifted away. And so it's pretty easy to see that this process kind of fundamentally involves back reaction. Well, the instanton decay process that I've been talking about. I'm not, yeah.
So including what the alternative calculations that you
would have? Oh, well, I mean, for example, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, you can, this is just Schwinger pair production. And so you could try and just study Schwinger pair, you know, De Sitter space with some electric field and consider some charge scalar field sitting in that De Sitter space and study pair production using the usual methods of Bogoluk. Yeah, but in the case where, well, but in 1 plus 1 dimensions, if you're deriving the creation of charged particles, that describes the, you know, sort of the relaxation of the cosmological constant. And so that's precise, yeah, so you, okay, so I think. I mean, and people have studied this, you know, using Bogoluk transformations and these usual techniques. And, but it, you know, it turns out that this only gives a check for these sub-horizon bubbles, okay? And so let me just conclude by saying that one can find examples of Silverstein's construction with, you know, that obey this bound where the tension is much bigger than the square root of the cosmological constant. And so if this conjecture is indeed true, then this would give a stable De Sitter background.
I still understand. I haven't heard an argument for stability. I've just heard an argument that you don't trust the instant calculation.
Well, no, I think that. I mean, I think that the simplest argument is that, you know, if all of the instabilities would give you a lifetime that's longer than the Poincaré recurrence time, then.
But you, what you told us essentially was the way you calculate the decay is not trustworthy. You don't believe in the linear calculation it yields a result which is contradicts causality.
Right.
Therefore, do you have an alternate way of doing the calculation?
No. No,
so
this is just a speculation. This is not, I haven't proved anything to you. I'm not claiming to have proved anything.
Well, they're ahead in the game because it's extremely hard to produce anything that's even determinatively stable and looks like De Sitter space in string theory. So if you can find something that's stable already over several Hubble times, I think that's progress. That's maybe not ultimately what you want, but it's a hard problem.
Usually,
when you try to do that, some multi-lab on the way.
I thought the methods you were using, the Euclidean calculation as a lifetime, after the day of the city, you argued didn't work.
Right, but if you.
The region you're now discussing.
Yes, that's right.
Therefore, what's the conclusion from that?
So I think the conclusion is that we don't know, and we won't know until we know
the
right.
Why is the conclusion that they're stable?
Well, no. I said if the conjectures. I mean, this is. I'm not.
It also didn't work. The conjectures stable.
Yeah, I'm not claiming. I'm not claiming to have proved anything to you.
It's remarkable in the sense that in most cases you will see within 1 minute that it's unstable, even perturbative.
One unlikely that you could rule out stability.
Well, okay, I haven't ruled out any instability. I mean, okay, I think at this point.
Or estimated the lifetime because you told us that the estimate of the lifetime is based on Salopon, which leads to, which you argue doesn't make any sense.
But the intuition is that as you increase the height of the barrier, you're going to increase the lifetime. And so what he's saying is that he can sort of basically change the model to make that barrier kind of bigger and bigger.
Right.
So it sounds like you can make the lifetime very, very long. Now,
the actual lifetime.
Maybe we should consider continuing the discussion.
there any normal questions?
Thanks.